It was still dark when the call came in. A body on the side of a rural Mississippi road, no witnesses waiting, no vehicle stopped nearby. Just headlights cutting across grass and gravel, and the sound of insects filling the gaps where answers should have been. Deputies arrived and saw the damage right away. Gunshot wounds, close enough to kill, far enough to leave no obvious trail. The victim was identified within hours as Mesha Caldwell, a transgender woman whose life had already required caution before it ended in violence. By midday, the story had moved beyond the county line. By nightfall, it was national. Headlines formed fast, so did assumptions. Activists demanded clarity. Law enforcement urged restraint. The word hate crime began circulating before the evidence was fully logged. What lay on that roadside was more than a body. It was a case under pressure from every direction. A crime scene with limited facts. A victim whose identity shaped the narrative before the investigation could catch up. And from the start, one problem refused to go away. The questions were louder than the proof. Chapter 1, The Roadside Discovery. The call reached dispatch just after dawn. A passerby reported a body along a rural stretch of road in Mississippi. The location was quiet, bordered by grass and scattered trees. No businesses nearby, no houses close enough to notice anything overnight. Patrol units were sent with lights off for the final approach, a habit learned from years of working scenes that needed to stay intact. The first deputy arrived to find a woman lying near the edge of the roadway. She was motionless. There was no sign of a vehicle stopped nearby, no debris field, no obvious skid marks. The position of the body suggested she had not been struck by a car. This was not an accident call for long. Backup arrived within minutes. The area was taped off. Traffic was diverted down a narrow shoulder. The early morning air was cool, but humidity was already building. Insects gathered around the lights. Every minute that passed threatened whatever evidence remained. A quick assessment confirmed gunshot wounds. The injuries were fatal. There was no pulse. No attempt at resuscitation was made. The victim was pronounced dead at the scene. From that moment, the case shifted from response to preservation. Investigators documented the position of the body, the surrounding terrain, and the condition of the road. Photographs were taken from multiple angles. Shell casings were not immediately visible. The lack of obvious evidence raised concern. A shooting without casings suggested distance, collection by the shooter, or a different location altogether. Identification came early. The victim was recognized as Mesha Caldwell. She was known within the local community. Her name appeared in records. Her identity added a layer of sensitivity that investigators were trained to handle, but knew would complicate the public response. Mesha Caldwell was a transgender woman. That fact was noted in reports for accuracy, not emphasis. On the ground, it changed nothing about how the scene was processed. In the public sphere, it would change everything. As the coroner arrived, investigators began reconstructing what little they had. There were no visible signs of a struggle, no scattered personal items, no drag marks leading away from the road. The body's placement suggested she had been left there deliberately. Whether she was shot at that location or moved after death was not yet clear. The roadway itself offered few answers. It was a known cut through the area, used by locals and anyone trying to avoid busier routes. At night, it was dark. Headlights would be visible from a distance, but details would be lost. A gunshot could carry, but so could plausible deniability. In rural areas, sounds blend easily into the background. Investigators canvassed the immediate area. No one reported hearing shots. No one had seen a suspicious vehicle. A few residents acknowledged traffic during the night, but could not offer specifics. Time was already working against the case. By mid-morning, word reached local media. A homicide had occurred. Details were sparse, as they often are early. The victim's name circulated quickly, pulled from public records and social media. Within hours, the story spread beyond the county. Law enforcement held a brief press statement. They confirmed a homicide investigation was underway. They confirmed the victim's identity. They did not discuss motive. They did not label the crime. They asked for tips. That restraint did not last long in the wider conversation. As national outlets picked up the story, context was added that investigators had not yet established. The killing of a transgender woman on a roadside fit a pattern many already believed they understood. Past cases were cited, statistics were shared, The word hate appeared in headlines and commentary. Inside the investigation, the focus remained narrow. Detectives reviewed Caldwell's recent movements. They sought phone records. They identified last known contacts. None of that information was public yet. None of it could answer the central question forming around the case. Was this a targeted act driven by bias, or was it something else entirely? The distinction mattered. In Mississippi, hate crime classification carried specific legal implications. It required proof of motive tied to protected characteristics. That proof could not come from assumption or pattern alone. It had to come from evidence tied directly to the suspect and the act. At the scene, evidence was thin. The absence of shell casings remained unresolved. Investigators noted tire impressions, but could not immediately determine relevance. The road was traveled enough that distinguishing a suspect vehicle would be difficult. The body was transported for autopsy. Cause of death would be confirmed there, along with trajectory, distance indicators, and any additional injuries. Until then, the scene told only part of the story. Internally, the case was logged like any other homicide. Externally, it was already becoming something larger. Advocacy groups issued statements calling for justice. Some named the killing as part of an epidemic. Others urged law enforcement to treat the case with urgency and transparency. Both demands were not incompatible, but they created pressure that investigators had learned to navigate carefully. Detectives knew that early missteps could lock a case into a narrative that facts might not support. They had seen it before. Once a theory takes hold publicly, evidence that contradicts it is often dismissed or attacked. By the end of the first day, the investigation had more questions than answers. Where had Caldwell been before her death? Who was the last person to see her alive? Why this road? Why this time? None of those questions could be answered at the scene. None could be rushed. The body was gone, the tape came down, traffic resumed, the road returned to silence. What remained was a file, a name, and a growing divide between what was known and what was believed. The case had begun under darkness, and already the pressure surrounding it threatened to outpace the evidence. That gap would define everything that followed. Chapter 2, The Investigation and the Narrative. The investigation moved indoors as soon as the scene work ended. Detectives gathered in a small briefing room, walls lined with maps and dry erase boards left over from older cases. A timeline began to form, thin at first. Time of discovery, estimated time of death pending autopsy, known movements still blank. They started where they always did. Phones, Caldwell's phone records were requested, along with location data. It would take time. Subpoenas moved slower than headlines. Investigators also pulled surveillance from gas stations and small businesses along routes that fed into the rural road. Coverage was uneven, some cameras were outdated, others overwrote data quickly. The autopsy confirmed what responders had already suspected. Caldwell died from gunshot wounds. The manner of death was ruled a homicide. Trajectory analysis suggested shots fired from some distance. No evidence of close-range discharge was noted. That finding aligned with the absence of shell casings at the roadside. Investigators considered the possibility that the shooting occurred elsewhere. A vehicle shooting was one working theory. Another was that the shooter stood far enough away to avoid leaving recoverable evidence. Neither theory could be elevated without corroboration. Victimology became the focus. Caldwell's recent activities were reconstructed through interviews. Friends described her routines, where she liked to go, who she trusted, who she avoided. There were no immediate reports of threats, no known disputes that rose to the level of motive. That absence was not evidence of absence. Detectives knew that crimes against transgender victims often involved interactions that never reached official channels. Many went unreported, many stayed informal. Still, they needed something concrete. As the days passed, pressure intensified, national coverage expanded. Caldwell's death was cited alongside other killings of transgender women across the country. Patterns were drawn, numbers were repeated. Each reference increased the expectation that this case fit a familiar mold. Investigators issued statements urging patience. They confirmed the facts they could confirm. They refused to classify motive without evidence. That refusal drew criticism from some quarters. Silence was interpreted as reluctance. Caution was read as avoidance. Inside the department, the line was clear. A hate crime designation required proof that Caldwell was targeted because of her gender identity. That proof could come from statements, communications, or actions directly tied to the suspect. None of that existed yet. Tips came in. Many were vague, some were driven by fear, others by anger. A few pointed to known offenders in the area without specifics. Each had to be logged. Each had to be checked. Most went nowhere. Investigators tracked Caldwell's last confirmed sighting. It placed her alive hours before the estimated time of death. She had been moving through familiar spaces. Nothing unusual stood out. No one reported an argument. No one reported a strange vehicle following her. Cell phone data eventually provided partial clarity. Caldwell's phone stopped moving near the location where her body was found. Whether that meant the shooting occurred there, or simply where the phone was discarded, remained unclear. Without a weapon or suspect, interpretation stayed limited. The case entered a dangerous phase. Evidence was static. Public expectations were accelerating. Advocacy groups organized vigils. Speakers called for accountability. Some named law enforcement failures before the investigation reached a month old. Others demanded federal involvement. Each event brought renewed attention and renewed scrutiny. Detectives understood the pain driving those calls. They also understood the risk. Once a case becomes symbolic, it can be consumed by what it represents rather than what it is. Evidence does not expand under pressure. It contracts. Media requests multiplied. Investigators declined interviews that went beyond confirmed facts. They reiterated their request for information. They emphasized that the case remained active. Behind closed doors, frustration grew. A homicide with no suspect is a weight every investigator carries. One tied to national outrage becomes heavier. They revisited the scene data. Tire impressions were reviewed again. Analysts attempted to isolate patterns consistent with a specific vehicle class. The results were inconclusive. Too many cars had passed before the area was secured. Firearms databases were queried for similar cases. No immediate matches surfaced. Without casings or bullets tied to a known weapon, the path stalled. Some investigators worried the case would freeze permanently. Others believed time would bring clarity. Someone always talks, they said. Someone always slips. But time also erodes memory. It blunts urgency. It shifts focus. As weeks turned into months, Caldwell's name resurfaced periodically in national reporting. Each new article framed the case as unresolved. Each reiterated the lack of arrest. Each returned to the same central question. Why? Law enforcement responses remained consistent. The case was open, leads were being followed, no suspect had been identified, motive remained undetermined. The gap between what could be said and what was demanded widened. By the end of the first year, the investigation had entered a familiar but uncomfortable status. Active but quiet, reviewed but unchanged. Detectives rotated, files stayed. The story outside continued to grow louder, the story inside grew thinner, and at the center of both stood a single, unresolved tension. Whether the truth of what happened to Mesha Caldwell would ever emerge, or whether the case would remain defined by the questions it left behind. Chapter 3, Silent Scrutiny and What Remains. By the time the case reached its second year, the investigation had settled into a quiet that felt heavier than noise. The file remained open. Leads were reviewed and re-reviewed. None crossed the threshold needed to move the case forward. There was no arrest, no suspect named, no weapon recovered. Law enforcement acknowledged the reality without dressing it up. Evidence was limited. Witnesses had not come forward. The passage of time had narrowed options rather than expanded them. Each public statement repeated the same facts, careful and restrained. The family waited inside that restraint. For those closest to Mesha Caldwell, grief had shifted shape. The first weeks after the killing were consumed by shock and logistics, funerals, paperwork, questions with no answers. As months passed, grief hardened into something else, frustration, exhaustion, a sense of being left behind as attention moved on. Community members continued to speak Caldwell's name. Vigils became anniversaries. Anniversaries became markers of time passing without resolution. Each one carried the same demand. Someone had killed her. Someone knew something. Between 2020 and 2023, renewed coverage brought the case back into focus. National outlets revisited unsolved killings of transgender women. Caldwell's story reappeared, often framed alongside others. The facts remained unchanged, but the context evolved. Investigators were asked again about motive, about hate crime classification, about whether bias had played a role. Their answers stayed careful. No motive had been legally established. No evidence tied the killing directly to Caldwell's gender identity. That did not rule it out. It simply meant the standard required to prove it had not been met. That distinction frustrated many. For advocates, the absence of proof did not equal absence of reality. They argued that patterns mattered, that history mattered, that lived experience filled the gaps evidence could not. Law enforcement did not publicly dispute those broader truths. Their role, they maintained, was narrower. They could not charge patterns, they could only charge people. The silence of the case fed suspicion. In some corners, it fed distrust. Mississippi's history with marginalized victims hovered in the background, whether spoken or not. Each unsolved case added weight to that history. Internally, the case remained a reminder of limits. Not every homicide yields to persistence. Not every truth announces itself. Some crimes are designed to disappear into gaps, rural roads, late hours, no witnesses, no cameras. Detectives rotated out of the unit. New names inherited the file. They read through reports written years earlier. They traced the same dead ends. They made the same calls, just in case something had changed. Sometimes it had. Sometimes a number no longer worked. Sometimes a person had moved. Sometimes memory failed. The case file grew thicker but not stronger. Public trust became its own parallel issue. Each year without answers chipped at confidence. Calls for accountability broadened. They were no longer just about Caldwell's death. They were about what her unsolved case represented. Officials responded by reiterating commitment. They emphasized that unsolved did not mean abandoned. They encouraged tips. They reminded the public that even small details could matter. Few arrived. In the absence of resolution, Caldwell's life began to risk being overshadowed by the circumstances of her death. Friends pushed back against that. They shared stories. They insisted she be remembered as more than a headline, more than a statistic. That effort mattered, but it did not solve the crime. By the time coverage renewed again, the case had become something fixed in the public imagination. An example, a question mark, a test of whether justice would ever reach certain victims. For investigators, the weight of that symbolism was both understood and resisted. They could not solve the case by meaning alone. They needed evidence. They needed a break. None came. The final reality of the case was not dramatic. There was no last-minute confession, no recovered weapon, no courtroom reckoning. There was only continuation. An open file, a name on a list of unsolved homicides, a family still waiting. What justice means in that space is difficult to define. For some, it means accountability that may never arrive. For others, it means refusing to let the case fade completely. For law enforcement, it means acknowledging uncertainty without surrendering responsibility. The road where Caldwell was found looks ordinary now. Cars pass without slowing, grass grows back. There is no marker that tells drivers what happened there. But the absence of answers does not erase the question. Someone killed Mesha Caldwell. That fact has never changed. What remains unknown is whether the silence surrounding her death will ever be broken, or whether the cost of that silence will be carried indefinitely by those left behind. The case remains open.